Well, I think we'll go ahead and get started, and the rest of people can kind of trickle in as they do. You know, it's the holiday season when it goes, we have 40 RSVPs and we get 10, a good group, though, of 10.
10 hardcore.
It's hardcore. So thank you all for coming. We will be recording this, so we'll have it up on our website for the rest of everybody else who missed it can hear it later. I'm just going to quickly start with a quick introduction about ASP and then introduce our esteemed speaker here, Dr. Josh Busby. He'll give a presentation, and then we should have a little bit of time for conversation and everything like that. So the American Security Project, for those of you, I think most of you have been here before, but we are a national security-focused think tank started in 2006 by a bipartisan group of senators and former senators, Senators Kerry and Hagel and Hart and Rudman, to look at the big questions of national security, to get beyond the partisan divides and partisan trench warfare, and to look at, okay, what are the big threats and opportunities looming for the next 10 years, the next 20 years, and what do we need to do to address those now? And when you do kind of take that longer view, that you can come to some sort of bipartisan agreement, we found on some things. Climate change and security is a big part of what we've done, and we've made it a focus here. We think it's a very important part of what the United States should be focusing on over the long term. So that's why we're so excited to have Dr. Josh Busby here. He's a professor at the University of Texas at Austin, author of two books, More Movements in Foreign Policy, and just recently, AIDS, Drugs for All, right?
Mm-hmm.
But those aren't the reason why he's here today. He's here because he's the leader of the Climate Change and African Political Stability Research Program, really an admirable cross-organizational group housed at the University of Texas, but with input from all over the world. It's really done some first-class work. And I love their maps, so I'm excited when he said, can I bring a PowerPoint? Usually I say, nah, it's better, but no, we got to have a PowerPoint for this. The CCAPS program is funded by DOD's Minerva Initiative, and we look forward to hearing about it and hearing about the work you're doing and where we're going from there. So with that, I'll turn it over to you, and we can go from there.
Thanks so much for the introduction. Delighted to be here. Good to see all of you out in this meeting right before the holidays. The title of my talk is Climate Security Vulnerability in Africa, Strategic Implications for the United States. And as you've heard, the work is carried out under the Climate Change and African Political Stability Program, which is funded by the Minerva Initiative from DOD. We're now in the fifth and final year of that effort. And as you heard, it's a collaborative effort with a number of different researchers from different institutions around the U.S. and other places. It has three main components, looking at the causal connections between climate change and security outcomes, a second looking at governance and climate change, and a third looking at foreign aid and adaptation to climate change. The first strand is the one that I'm really involved in, which is this effort to map climate security vulnerabilities and think about the implications for the United States. Just by way of background, I've been writing about climate change and security for almost 10 years, having started on the topic in a short piece with Nigel Purvis for the Woodrow Wilson Center and the UN High-Level Panel on Threats, Challenges, and Change back in 2004. And then since then, I've tried to write for both policy and academic outlets, straddling both. So have a piece that I did for the Council on Foreign Relations in 2007, more recent work for Brookings and also the German Marshall Fund. On the academic side, I've published in Security Studies in 2008, and then in 2013, a big piece in international security. Along the way, I served as an external advisor to the NICS National Intelligence Assessment in 2008 on this topic. But what I wanted to do today is present more or less a culmination of nearly 5 years of effort trying to pin down climate change security vulnerabilities, sort of a term of art that I'll explain in a little bit, in Africa, and intersect that with an understanding of U.S. strategic interests on the continent. And the impetus for this work is that Africa's strategic importance to the United States appears to be rising, and at the same time, there's an understanding of Africa's particular vulnerability to climate change. So those one piece in the in foreign policy, which may overstate it a bit, it says with a French military incursion into Mali, terrorism spreading, Somalia struggling for a foothold in narco and arms trafficking across West Africa, among other security concerns, the U.S. military has plenty to worry about. Kind of capturing the notion that Africa's strategic importance may be rising, and at the same time, the Defense Science Board's 2011 report suggests that climate change effects in Africa destabilize fragile states by overloading the political systems and eroding governmental legitimacy. And there are a whole host of reasons why the U.S. may be concerned. And so this paper is really an effort to try to see about the intersection of where those climate vulnerabilities are located with U.S. strategic interests. I don't think that's really been done before. This particular presentation is flows from a collaborative work with Jennifer Hazen at BAE Systems in Stuttgart, as well as some of my other frequent collaborators at the University of Texas. And we overlay our indicators of strategic significance on base layers of climate security vulnerability. So what I want to do today in my 25 to 30 minutes is try to introduce or give some discussion of U.S. strategic interests on the continent, provide overlays on our climate security model, and then talk about the implications. So this is more or less what I just said. In terms of strategic interests, to think about the ways that climate change might affect U.S. strategic interests, I draw upon both the 2007 CFR report that I did as well as the 2008 Security Studies article. And in terms of one way to think about it is in terms of direct threats to the homeland, threats to Americans, and threats to interests. And in terms of Africa's relation to the United States, really we're either talking about threats to Americans or threats to U.S. interests. There are few, if any, direct threats to the U.S. Homeland emanating from Africa. But when we think about threats to Americans, we might think about threats to embassies, military bases to the extent that there are any, and threats to U.S. interests. There, we might think about threats to U.S. allies, threats to critical security partners, threats to key nodes in the global economy, key pathways for the transportation of goods, threats that may affect access to natural resources and economic markets, or the ways in which climate change may intersect and enhance or detract from the capabilities of violent extremist groups. And so this is kind of a theoretical way to think about where U.S. interests might be affected by climate change. In both the 2007 and 2008 pieces, I try to think through how and whether climate change may have some bearing on these questions. But what we wanted to do is, and I'll come back to that in a little bit, is try to, with maps, try to figure out where we think the climate vulnerabilities are located, and where, if we can find proxies for some of these different kinds of potential threats to U.S. interests, where those two kinds of problems conjoin. So in terms of climate security vulnerability, for people who are not familiar with the model that we've done before, I'm going to briefly walk through it. And here, we're now in the third iteration of almost third and a half. We're calling the Climate Security Vulnerability Model 3.0. And the effort is to identify the likely locations where large numbers of people could be at risk of death from exposure to climate-related hazards. And that's, such situations may or may not escalate to conflict. And our effort is to identify the places of perennial concern, the chronic hotspots at the subnational level where we think climate vulnerabilities are likely to be concentrated. And so what we do is we classify Africa relative to the rest of itself, not relative to the rest of the world. And because our emphasis is security-related, our vulnerability maps are different from other approaches that emphasize livelihoods. So this is like a snapshot portrait of the places that we think are likely to be perennial places of concern. And the intuitions behind this model are that climate exposure alone does not make a place vulnerable to climate change. It depends on whether people live there, what are the resources that communities have to protect themselves, and whether their governments are willing to come to their aid in times of need. And we synthesize a variety of indicators of physical exposure, population density, household and community resilience, and governance into a composite index. In its simplest form, it was we just initially added each of those sort of sub-baskets that were that have indicators within them. Yeah, we initially added them together. In the most recent refinement, there's a little bit of a wrinkle on that, and I can talk about it more in the Q&A. I'll describe a little bit in a second. So what this, one thing I should mention is that you can play with the very nearly latest version of the data, including the base layer maps on our dashboard, and you can reweight the index, the additive model, to your own liking. And so I encourage people, and I'll make these slides available afterwards. But this is the latest version of our maps, which is a departure even from what's on that dashboard, because it's always a work in progress. We're always looking for better data, finding fine-grained subnational data for Africa for both physical exposure and the household level is always a challenge, and we're on the hunt forever trying to find better data. But this is our latest version of the composite index, where we synthesize and bring these various factors together. And what you see is that vulnerabilities, we think, are concentrated in Somalia, Eastern Ethiopia, Uganda, pockets in the DRC, Nigeria, coastal Madagascar, Mozambique, and Egypt along the Nile. And if you're familiar with our maps, this is a departure from previous work. So the 2.0 effort, which is described both methodologically and in map form, is in the spring edition of International Security. But the 3.0 edition is described in a recent policy brief that we did for the Strauss Center and the CCAPS program, although we've continued to refine it even since that policy brief, so I need to do an updated version of the policy brief. So let me just briefly describe what are the changes from the 2.0 to the 3.0 plus. One of the things that we had is some recommendations from reviewers over the years is, you know, present us an alternative functional form rather than, you could have a high total score on your composite index even if you weren't physically exposed to these climate hazards. And so in this version of the model, we multiply the climate hazard by the other three baskets, which means that if you're low on climate exposure, you're low on the total index score. So that's one change. And I should mention that the physical exposure basket, and we can talk about this more in the Q&A, consists of data on historic exposure to cyclones, wildfires, drought, chronic water scarcity, floods, and low elevation coastal zones. And it's our first point of departure. To, you know, the best predictor of climate change in the future is what's happened in the past, because climate models heretofore have not been very accurate or very fine-grained in their predictions for where climate change is likely to affect the continent in the future. But we have done collaborations with climate scientists, so another stream of research is looking at 2050 projections of climate change to see if the places that we find that have historically been exposed to these climate hazards are the same ones projected to be in the future. And I don't think I've got slides in this deck to talk about that, but I can, in the Q&A, tell you, describe a little bit more about that process, which is under review at the moment. But beyond this multiplicative model change, we've done some new procedures to normalize the model on a 0 to 1 scale, as opposed to quintile classification, and I can talk about that in the Q&A if there's interest. We've got new admin 1 shapefiles for Africa, so trying to get provincial data, or get basically drawing Africa provincial maps. We have synthesized from different sources and used Africa admin 1 level shapefiles, which is a bit of a departure from previous. Or we've got new revised subnational indicators in the physical basket and new revised subnational indicators in the household basket. So I can talk more about that in the Q&A. So But to really get at the matter at hand today is, where do U.S. strategic interests and climate security vulnerability conjoin? And that's really the most recent iteration of our research, which is a work in progress, and we're certainly open to feedback on this. And what we're trying to do here is identify indicators of U.S. strategic interests, proxies for that, that one could overlay on this climate security vulnerability model to see where those factors conjoin. So we identified several that are indicators of U.S. strategic interest: where raw materials are located, including oil and critical minerals, where terrorism events have taken place on the continent, where piracy events have taken place, and the location of U.S. embassies and consulates, again, to see where U.S. strategic interests and climate security vulnerability are co-located. And so here's the first one, which is drawing from USGS data on oil fields. It's a little bit dated, and again, a lot of our work suggests that, you know, with better data, with more. This is from 2001 on oil fields, and we know that USGS has collected a whole host of data on new oil discoveries, oil and gas discoveries, but they haven't made it public, and so in part because of funding constraints. But a lot of what we think we can do with this kind of work is, if better and more recent data is released, or perhaps there's some that's available that if you have adequate security clearances, you can get a sense of, we know where some of the places that have oil fields are, obviously like Nigeria, but it helps concentrate the minds when you can intersect that with the climate concerns. And so one of the things that we have to step back from is, okay, so does climate change present a particular risk to oil installations? We often think of these maps as points of departure of where to focus future investigative energies. There are other places like Egypt that, you know, don't necessarily spring to mind as major oil producers, but nonetheless, I believe they're the fifth largest oil producer in Africa, much of it for their own home consumption. And then there are other places. And obviously there may be, with newer data, the ability to see if there are intersects of both the climate security base layer and where oil originates from. And then the kind of follow-on questions we have to ask is, okay, would climate events potentially disrupt access to these infrastructure sites for oil? Are we thinking about the kinds of effects that emanated from Hurricane Katrina taking oil installations offline? Are there ways in which security effects that are related to climate change might empower individuals who have interests hostile to oil production? Is that a possibility? All of those things are great questions. What our work does is set things up for people to think about where are the places that we need to try to ask those questions. So we do the same thing with critical mineral resources in relation to climate vulnerability. And here, there's not a really clear story. The kinds of strategic minerals that the U.S. is interested in, like rare earths, are produced overwhelmingly in China. None are produced in Africa. We did a list of what were deemed critical minerals. This is a list that was derived from the European Union. And most of the mineral sites are, in terms of volume and major export, are concentrated in Southern Africa and South Africa in particular, which from a climate security perspective is resilient. It has relatively resilient compared to the other places on the continent, so we can come back to that. But from a minerals perspective, I mean, there are, you know, pockets here and there in the Great Lakes, in Madagascar, but from, in terms of sheer numbers, there's not a clear story emanating from the minerals perspective. In terms of terrorism events, there a large number of terrorism events were concentrated in Algeria. By this is data coming from the global terrorism database that we geocoded. So this is for the period 2000 to 2010. If you look at a sort of slice of 2008, 2009 forward, the events do move a bit from Algeria south to the Sahel. But in terms of sheer numbers, you have most events beyond Algeria are concentrated in Nigeria and Somalia. But there's, you know, one of the challenges is that these are highly correlated with a conflict indicator, which is already in our governance basket on some level. So it's kind of, it's on, in a sense, it's on both sides of the ledger. So it's unclear these groups. You know, one of the things I'll come back to is even if you think that there are, you know, large number of even if you think that that you know, terrorism events are concentrated in climate vulnerable places like Somalia and Nigeria, it's unclear if that necessarily poses a threat to the United States and its interests. The maps don't tell us that; they just tell us where the events are located. We have to use other information to assess the extent to which these groups have local grievances or are ones that actually have interests inimical to the United States. Obviously, the U.S. government and the Pentagon have taken an active interest in a variety of groups deploying terrorism as a tactic, as concerns about a kind of wider al-Qaeda franchisees on the continent. This, you know, suggests that there are some concerns that may be corroborated in terms of where these locations are co-occurring, but it doesn't tell us what to do about that, and we can come back to that in a little bit. We also do a similar effort taking other people's geocoded data on piracy, and not surprisingly, you know, if you're familiar with what's happened off the coast of Somalia and off the coast of Nigeria, that most terrorism events, again, are coming off the Gulf of Aden, or the Bights of Benin and Bani. If you follow the story over the last couple of years, this goes up through 2011 and 2012, 2013. The events off of the coast of Somalia have sort of dropped off a cliff as more robust interdiction efforts have taken place. But we know that if for any reason we as an international community, or the U.S. in particular, were to step away from that effort, Somalia is not the most stable of places to interdict and stop these piracy attacks on their own. But increasingly, concerns have migrated off the coast of Nigeria. So again, you know, Nigeria and Somalia across a number of these maps are looming large as places that we think are vulnerable from a climate security perspective. And in terms of security interests, strategic interests that the U.S. has an interest in, are also occurring there as well. The last indicator is trying to just look at where U.S. embassies and consulates are concentrated. And here you might think of either embassies that perhaps are located in climate vulnerable areas, or from a slightly different perspective, that they might be called upon in emergency times to coordinate efforts at humanitarian relief. So some that might be directly physically exposed would be, they are a consulate in Alexandria. Other embassies, as I suggested, may not be in harm's way, but in the embassy in Addis or Nairobi might be ones that are called upon to coordinate humanitarian efforts in a region. So, what are the implications of this? Well, one way to think about it is taking a step back and thinking about differentiating between where are strategic interests located and where are the climate vulnerabilities. And you can create, political scientists like me love 2x2 matrices. So we have, one way to think about it is where are the places that are climate vulnerable, where are the places that are climate resilient, where are the places we have strategic, significant strategic interests, and where we have trivial ones. And so when you combine those four possibilities, you end up with places where you think climate vulnerability and strategic interests are significant, and that's really the core focus of concern in this paper. Those are areas that we might think of as coupled, or that they're either twin challenges that countries either simultaneously are faced by security problems and climate change, or perhaps they're causally related, and we'll talk about that in a second. There are another possibility is where U.S. has significant strategic interests, but the local place, either country level or subnational level, is climate resilient. And here, local leadership really should take the initiative and can take the initiative, and the U.S. can play a kind of assisting role. And here, South Africa comes to mind as a place that in pockets in South Africa are maybe vulnerable to climate change, but overall the country's relatively resilient. But the U.S. has strategic interests, both from a regional perspective and for access to critical minerals. But again, South Africa is really in a position relative to the rest of the continent to take the lead in addressing those problems. There are other situations where U.S. has limited, maybe trivial is perhaps too fine a point on it. U.S. has, if I were in government, I probably would not say trivial, but I'm not, so I can say trivial. We could say, if we're to be more diplomatic about it, we could say the U.S. has limited strategic interests in some places. But those places may be highly vulnerable to climate change. Ethiopia might be a good example there. You have few or limited security interests in Ethiopia proper, but the place's climate vulnerability, and here from a humanitarian perspective, you may be more involved. And then the last set of cases are ones where we don't have strategic interest in the place's climate resilience, so who cares? The cases that we're most interested in are those in that first cell where they're coupled, and it's really, if we're trying to think about what to do, we have to have a better appreciation of are they causally related? And there's been a vast explosion of literature both in the policy and academic worlds about is climate change causing conflict? And for a long time I've been writing about this issue saying, well, that's a really sort of narrow vision of the security outcomes that are possible as a consequence of climate change. And the most proximate and immediate ones are, does climate change cause large-scale disasters such that large numbers of people might die and require mobilization of militaries to come to their aid in times of need. But if we're trying to think through theoretically what the potential relationships are from a causal story, they aren't always negative ones. You could have climate change causing, or along with other things, contributing to conflict onset, causing large-scale disasters, famine and the like, but you could also imagine that climate change may lessen or ameliorate security outcomes. So the 2011 famine in Somalia, there was a sense in which it had put al-Shabaab on its heels for a bit. Obviously it didn't go away and it's had something of a resurgence of late, but there may be episodes in which climate hazards actually reduce security concerns. But then another way to think about it is that perhaps even if one doesn't cause the other, there may be sort of security spillovers that emanate from climate change. And so one of these we might think about is it complicates the ability to provide. There may be spillovers in both directions. So you have a drought occurring in the midst of a conflict zone, and it creates a more difficult problem in providing humanitarian relief. Or other possibilities are that that maybe along the lines of causally related, but you could imagine this was a concern after the recent Filipino cyclone, that insurgent groups might take advantage of the power vacuum after a climate hazard to then either move into an area that the government has moved out of or has been decimated by events in the midst of looting and ongoing absence of national or local security services. And so much of the work that I think remains to be done in this space is trying to tease through these linkages in a more direct and helpful manner. One of the things that we've tried to do, and I'll give you a short application of this, is to try to look at this in the context of some of the specific places that we identified as of concern from both a climate security perspective and from a strategic perspective. So the first of these that we've done is on Somalia, and we're extending that work to look at Nigeria and possibly Mali, but we might do Egypt as well, because that stands out more directly from our modeling work than Mali does. And so I'll take the last few minutes to give you some intuitions about how we're trying to think about the relationship between these climate hazards and security outcomes in a particular place with the example of Somalia. So we've done a pull-out map of Somalia. There's overwhelming vulnerability in Somalia from our base layer. And on that, you know, we've overlaid in the upper left-hand corner terrorism attacks, piracy attacks, modest oil and gas resources. And then here in this square, we've overlaid conflict events that have taken place since we included conflict in our model itself. So our conflict model goes up through 2012. These are all the conflict events that have happened in 2013 in Somalia. And just as a point of departure. And one of the things we want to analyze.
Could you go back? The light and dark, we've got high and low overall resiliency score. So what is the.
So high means high resilience, low means low resilience. And
and
means high.
How are you assessing risk? So this is just the, when you say, how do you create a resilience?
So we have four baskets, each of which has a number of sub-indicators that are based on historic exposure to all those climate hazards that I talk about. We have a second basket of population density. We have a third basket of household and community resilience, which includes access to education, health, daily necessities, and healthcare. All of these are added together, given certain weights, to create a basket level index. And then we have a similar one for governance, most of which are at the national level. But the presence of violence is a subnational indicator in that basket. Again, all these are added together, they're given certain weights. And then the last step is to create a composite index where, as I suggested earlier, we multiply the physical exposure index, this one, by the other three, and to create that.
So it's actually not just resilience, it's risk times resilience.
Well, I guess different people have different ways of describing it. So, our vulnerability or resilience metric combines a measure of physical exposure and these other dimensions. Depending on your disciplinary direction, you might say that risk and vulnerability are the same or they're different. There isn't as precise a specific meaning that is kind of uniformly understood in all fields.
Yes. Essentially, this red is your not this one, but
yes.
The last one you showed is your expectation of badness.
Yeah, exactly.
It's something. Andrew?
Yeah.
And Joshua, are we okay to having conversations?
Yeah,
with
I can
stuff through.
Yeah, I'm happy to. The only thing that we've tried to do, and I'll end here, and we can go into more detail
on
the Q&A.
Is we'll get you after.
Right. What we've tried to do is assess both in terms of broad patterns and for specific events, are there correlations between major climate hazards and either conflict onset or famine onset, both in terms of general trends over time, but also for specific episodes. And the way we're trying to get that is that did a climate hazard precede immediately a conflict onset or other security outcome of concern. And one of the things that you find is that in the Somalia context, there are consistent patterns. And the conflict events in Somalia didn't spike up following major climate anomalies in Somalia. There aren't clear patterns there. Although some other studies using different methodologies have found some clear patterns, but this is an ongoing process. The coup that happened in 1991, there wasn't a climate hazard event that preceded. Here's the conflict. The climate hazard happens a little bit after that. There have been a period of dry anomalies that happened in the lead up to that coup in 1991 that might have led to deteriorating economic conditions, but it requires a bit of a stretch to make that claim that
actually, if you go into the history, the serious revolt against Barry the serious, it's peaked and went serious in the 84 period.
Yeah.
And then it went through, and it so basically the people who overthrew him in 91 were established
right.
in the 84, 85 time period. So if you track back, there's
right.
a very close correlation. They went big and got support and
right.
then maintained their fighting against the regime from about 80, January 85.
But this is precisely the kind of close causal work that has to happen at specific case level. Because what has happened, I think, in this community is there's an effort to put climate and climate concerns as central to a variety of conflict and security episodes. It is not always done with the careful attention to trying to isolate whether or not a climate hazard preceded the onset of conflict episode. So I take your point there, and this is, like I said, an ongoing
work. It's hard, and I wouldn't have 20 years ago tied it to climate change.
Right.
And I'm not sure I would.
It may not. That's also true. It may just be weather anomalies that it wasn't clear if the anthropogenic climate signal had broken through at that point. The next one that we've also done is to try to see if climate anomalies, which are here dry anomalies, and specific famine events in the Somali context always co-occur. And one of the things that we found is that there were two major dry anomalies in 95 and then in 2002 that didn't result in famine, that were on par with the 2011 famine and the 92 famine. And so we can think of, in the context of famine episodes, that climate hazards may be necessary but not sufficient conditions. And so when we're trying to isolate whether or not climate change are causing security outcomes of concern, we have to think about those factors amidst others. And again, when we look at terrorism and piracy, clear pattern of major spikes in terrorism in Somalia or major spikes in piracy following weather anomalies. And so it's a real mixed portrait, but I think it is exactly the kind of careful process tracing that has to be done, because there was a literature on HIV, AIDS, and security outcomes and how this was going to be a tremendous concern because of issues related to orphans. That whole both intellectual agenda in the scholarly community and in the policy world disappeared. And so for people who are interested in the complex relationships between climate change and security outcomes, unless this is just a kind of faddish, flash in the pan sort of episode, we think that the climate security concerns are real, but we have to specify them with as much attention to detail as possible, lest the community of people who are interested in this agenda from both a research perspective and policy perspective get discredited because we end up making claims. So what does all this mean then for U.S. strategic interests? Because unless we isolate whether or not the climate factors are a contributing factor in some of the security outcomes of concern, it may be unclear exactly how to respond. And as I suggested earlier, with our maps of terrorism, we know that terrorism events are co-located in Somalia along with climate security vulnerability. What does that mean in terms of U.S. response? Well, it doesn't really tell you what to do. It doesn't even tell you whether or not Al-Shabaab poses a risk to the U.S. or U.S. interests. That has to come from other understandings that come from outside the maps. But I think what these maps hopefully do is give us a set of questions about how to concentrate the minds and think about, okay, what's the deep dive that we need to do to assess whether or not climate change is contributing to these security outcomes of concern? But we don't have to do it at the continental level. We can now focus our energies on the places that seem to come out from both sets of observations. But let me open it up to questions so that I can address all of your concerns. Let me go back and I'll come back forward. Yeah.
I'll start. First of all, this is fascinating to me, and I've been very interested in the data sources you've been drawing on. Wasn't clear whether you've been looking at agricultural land records for as an underlying strategic factor, that one would seem to be pretty significant for vulnerability, since it translates directly into creating and finding refugees. It also translates into mobilization of displaced or vulnerable groups of religious affiliations, which in turn translates into extremism on both sides, evangelical Muslim on the Christian side, and the more widely publicized side.
One of the challenges in this space is finding adequate indicators that are available continent-wide at the subnational level. And one of the extensions that we would like to do, and we've talked about some data using remote sensing, is to see if climate hazards intersect with existing environmental degradation. Most of the data that are available on this are available at the national level and don't give you fine-grained subnational variation that we think might intersect with these climate hazards. So the best proxies that we have in the context of our current model are measures of aridity, of chronic water scarcity, and deviations from normal rainfall, which would affect agriculture, but don't necessarily get at the issues related to land degradation itself that may be because of either deforestation or erosion and the like. There are some indicators that may be adequate proxies for that for rural areas, like the NVDI index, but that may be problematic for urban areas. But again, this is kind of where we'd like to take the work should we be given more analytical time and we can find that adequate proxies. But I think that's an important issue. Other questions? Let me go, Adam. Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
Two things. I went back to this is the problem of my work in Somalia was 20 years ago. So one of the three that overthrew Barry, 91 foreigner, so it was one of the three rebel movements. But Mark, can we go to the households?
Yeah, sure.
And it's just an indication of the problems. I mean, I'm uncomfortable necessarily with death as an indication, but quickly trying to look at this, for example, I don't see energy access. And so when I look at energy and resiliency in the face of disaster. Mm-hmm. You know, Fukushima created a resiliency challenge that would not have been the case if it were distributed power systems with energy efficiency.
Right.
That there's a whole set of infrastructure, and I don't know if it shows up in the other things, but there's a huge amount of infrastructure issues that have a variance on the implications for resiliency.
Right.
Let me do a step down, which overlaps with you.
Yeah.
We have the Africa Power Initiative.
Right.
The emphasis there, about 98% of the money it looks to be, is big, huge power systems replicating the United States rather than distributed power. We are creating a vulnerability to man-made and natural disasters in this way. We're increasing a climate vulnerability. You know, there's a question of what do we mean by resiliency?
Right.
And here, the energy, access to energy is issue in the developed world of resiliency. Here's an example that I'm not seeing. Yeah. I don't know if it's covered elsewhere.
Yeah. Sometimes, again, you have ideas when you start a project about, we wanted to include data on infrastructure like roads, for example. Obviously, roads could be affected by some natural hazard that might not be present when you're trying to extend relief. And we looked at data on both airports and road access, and just taking the example of roads for a second, the availability of an indicator that was consistently collected where a Cat 1 road meant the same thing in South Africa and in the DRC, well, it didn't. That same category of road was like an 8-lane highway in South Africa, and the DRC was like a dirt road, you know, and so trying to overlay that would create a misleading portrait. And so to a certain extent, you're constrained by the available data that you have. There are things that we imagine that might be important to intersect with our household basket with respect to infrastructure, but when you're trying to do this at a continent-wide level, it proposes some challenges. But what we have been able to do is that in this basket on the household level, you know, we have 6 of the 8 indicators in this basket are available at the subnational level. We have taken the USAID Demographic and Household Surveys and made them available on our website and downloadable for education indicators that heretofore haven't been available in that form. And we think that these give a measure of, you know, better educated people, healthier people, people with, in general, access to services, are going to be more resilient in times of emergency. Now, does this provide a complete portrait of all the things that may matter? No, it doesn't. Some of that is a function of data availability, but we think it's a major advance over what was available previously.
Could you give a very quick a sense of other areas where you think the data, we always, as analysts, we always have the challenge of we count, you know, we use what we can count, and therefore what
right.
counts matters and what's not counted.
So,
it's left to decide what are other areas.
So here's another thing is, like, does this represent anything real, right? This is these are models that we have that we think are a portrait of the places that are likely to be a chronic concern. How can you externally validate them to know that this is actually the true portrait of the underlying reality? That is the most complex question that we've had to deal with, aside from the indicators themselves. And so a lot of what we've tried to do is look at other indicators that were collected for different purposes to see if the patterns that are observed are the same ones. And so these are our efforts to geocode the MDAT International Disaster Database for both event totals and death totals and affected population totals to see if the patterns, the indices that were collected on historic exposure to climate disasters, which has a very specific meaning in the MDAT disaster database, which isn't just natural hazards, it's a measure of impact, that here are the patterns that are observed in another measure of event totals for the period 97 to 2011. They don't offer this at the geocoded level. We geocoded it at the admin one level. And the patterns are similar, but there's some distinct differences. Kenya, South Africa emerge more in terms of events. When you do population killed, there's some correspondence with ours. Again, Somalia looms large. Eastern Ethiopia, again, this is for the period 97 to 2011. And then people affected. More numbers in Ethiopia, more densely populated, Kenya emerges. But this is the effort, this gets to the nub of, did our maps provide any portrait of an underlying reality that one could externally validate with other sources to say, this is a real thing, or is this just an artifact of the model? But there are probably other areas, other indicators. Our governance basket, we would love to have better, most of these are national level indicators of government effectiveness, political stability. The only one is at the subnational level. We would love to have subnational indicators of government effectiveness. And there are other infrastructure things like access to energy. There's the lights at night. I always want to say lights at night. Nights at night. No, that's right. Lights at night. I always say it backwards. But that was done like 10 years ago. And so we're always worried about having proxy indicators that are, you know, way outdated, and the facts on the ground are very different. Let me capture some other questions here. You have one?
Yeah. So I wanted to, I found it very interesting that you had taken, you have this composite index that had all these different things, but it would be very interesting to sort of see a breakout of the large population with significant resilience compared to, in a different color, the large populations with lower resilience. For instance, my business is doing partnership strategy planning, and I approach those two baskets differently because the populations that are at large populations at risk that are poorly governed are a different basket than their neighbors who are relatively well governed but have large populations and therefore have large resources to be net security exports.
Right. Well, I think the online data tool allow you to do that. You can weight baskets differently. So the dashboard would give you some capability to do that. You could drop the household one, maybe, and it seems like it's
that's the main idea that you're expressing is, okay, so where are the large population concentrations? We know it's Nigeria, we know it's the central Great Lakes area, we know it is Ethiopia, to a certain extent in pockets in North Africa. It's a little harder to have it with the projection here with the JPEG, but there are pockets in Southern Africa. But when you intersect that with climate hazards and governance, South Africa drops out. Parts of Northern Africa in our previous iterations dropped out, and then there was the whole Arab Spring phenomenon, which required us to do a little updating on political stability. And that region has changed a lot from our, version one iteration of our maps. But that might be one way to get at it, is to have you play with the
English. Yeah, I was spending some time on the maps yesterday, and it's really cool. You can kind of layer it and weight it differently. It's fun. Really useful tool. I wanna unpack what is something you were just talking about with Arab Spring and Egypt. And previous iterations, it seemed like this was really a climate security in sub-Saharan Africa program.
Yeah.
And maybe that's just because that's the way it worked out. But now you see the Nile Delta region, Alexandria, really popping up as deep, deep red, and all along the Nile Valley.
Yeah.
And that seems to be even without taking into account the events since 2011. So, what's the implications of that?
There are a couple of things. One, we have more fine-grained coastal elevation information, which and the multiplicative model means that you no longer can have a high score on our total index if you have low physical exposure. And so that in part accounts for the change in Alexandria, but also we've updated the indicators for political stability to go up through 2011, whereas our initial indicators when we started this were through 2009, and a lot of things have changed there as well. And so the places that looked like they were resilient if you used political stability have changed quite a lot in the last couple of years, which, when you're doing a chronic snapshot and you're thinking that the best indicator of the future is the past, and you have regimes that hadn't changed, like Libya, for, nigh on 50 years, and suddenly they undergo a tremendous transformation, the past isn't always a good kind of future.
Right.
And it's harder to make, specific predictions about the future when it comes to political events. It's been very challenging in the climate modeling community to do that for the physical side of things. And so, again, we try and triangulate. We think that these are representations that give us some purchase on the future, but then we also try to compare it with other models of projections of future climate change to see if what's come up in our models based on the past or seem to be corroborated by the future. The future projections data, the Sahel looms larger in terms of the model projections for Africa, even if they don't loom as large in our maps. Part of that is that those models for the future vulnerability don't have population included. It's just a physical measure. And if you look at the Sahel, outside of northern Nigeria, it's not that densely populated, and so in terms of sheer numbers, even from a physical perspective, it may face more exposure to climate hazards, but in terms of the numbers of people who are likely to be affected, it's far smaller. And because population figures, that's another reason why Egypt stands out, is that it's highly densely populated.
Very
like
densely
that.
Populated, yeah, in a very concentrated area.
Other questions? Yeah, Lisa, please.
Well, I wanted to go back to Somalia, and I guess first of all, was Somalia the only country that you've done that kind of deep dive for?
We started it on Nigeria and Mali, and we'll probably do it on Egypt. But it was sort of once you get into the weeds of that, then you come into a situation where you're talking with someone who has deep country level expertise. Going back to the 1980s, and you're thinking, okay, they're going to call us out, so we've just got to read everything we can about Somalia and kind of. And so we're trying to do that, I think, on Nigeria, because we wanted to pick places that we think the U.S. Defense and foreign policy community cares about. And so we have thought about doing that with Mali, but it doesn't really come as clearly on our climate models as a place of concern. But we've done it for Somalia and started the others.
Well, then I guess, okay, so that's interesting. That'll be interesting to see. I'm curious what, you know, but if you're finding that there are significant climate vulnerabilities and yet they don't necessarily precede or trigger,
right,
you know, political events or terrorism events, what is it that you take from that? I mean, is it, and I guess, you know, do you sense that this is specific to Somalia, or does that tell you anything about the correlation in other countries?
Right.
What are you telling the defense community?
So I think, you know, there's been a lot of debate in the scholarly community about, are there clear associations between climate and conflict onset? And I've been engaged in debates with, you know, there's a prominent paper that came out by Shang et al. That, you know, made it clear, you know, they did a 60 study meta-analysis that they thought showed clear connections. But they, there were a lot of problematic methodological issues in that, even though it was kind of draped in the language of, you know, being the latest and best in scientific, you know, robust statistical analysis. The problem is that they aggregated across, aggregated from everything from studies that assess whether or not pitchers hit more batters on hot days to the onset of violent conflict at the Civil War level. So, and some studies dated back to like 1000 BC and all the way forward to the present. And the where this community has gone is there are different effects for rainfall perturbations. If you have too much rain, in some circumstances, that can lead to more conflict. If you have too little rain, in other circumstances, you can get conflict onset. But different kinds of conflict are affected differently by different climate hazards, and they don't have a uniform effect across time and space. And so, you know, people, so the worries about too much rain in pastoral areas is that it means that there's higher vegetation for people to hide to do cattle raiding, you know. And so this is where the community has gotten to, which, you know, does the U.S. care about, at all about, you know, high vegetation in pastoral areas? Maybe not, and maybe it shouldn't, right? Maybe that's just too much in the weeds, if you will, right? But do these things escalate up? Do, you know, is this the stuff that was the initial grounds in, you know, in Darfur that created the kind of pastoral agriculturalist conflict that then, in the context of wider issues, escalate into, you know, civil war and large scale depredations against human rights? I think the community, you know, wants to tell a story that is causally interesting to the policy community, but often stretches itself in ways that are problematic because it wants to be interesting. But it could be interesting today, but it might not be interesting in 2 years. And so I think our, you know, we're trying to be more careful than that, and, you know, it leads you into places where you go, well, it may not matter nearly as much as we thought, or it matters in very specific circumstances. Famine, you sometimes get it when you have major climate disturbances, but you don't always get famines when you have a major climate anomaly. It also depends on, you know, can outside aid groups get in? And so, you know, that was the main story, is that Al-Shabaab denied, you know, outside aid groups the capability to use the early warning systems to respond and deliver aid in situ in Somalia. So that meant hundreds of thousands had to migrate to neighboring Kenya and Ethiopia, and a whole host of them died unnecessarily. But the declining security environment in Somalia created conditions in Al-Shabaab's, you know, hardcore resoluteness against outside aid made it really problematic for aid groups to get in there. Now, Al-Shabaab's presence in Somalia may be a direct result of the U.S. deciding to back Ethiopia and overturn the Islamic courts in an earlier era. So it's not clear what the right policy should have been going back in time. We may have gotten that one wrong, but it's also unclear from the maps what we should do going forward. Do those groups, you know, with, you know, Somali diaspora now politicized in the United States and other places, it may not have been a problem then, but it may be a problem now, so what do you do about it? The maps are only points of departure for that extended discussion. Yeah, right here.
One other question. Sure. I appreciate the care you're taking not to promise more than you can deliver.
Right.
And that's sometimes remarkable, so getting on to the... I'd like to ask a soft power question.
Sure.
Does your model, in its current version, provide any guidance for strategies to mitigate climate impacts or build resilience?
So, one of the things that we did, and I don't have a slide on it here today, the World Bank and the African Development Bank have mapped their distribution of projects, active projects for Africa, all of the continent wide, and they're some of the first folks to do that. And when you look at that, and if you just do an East Africa pullout, I'll just go back to the composite for a second. Actually, I'll just go to this one. If you do that, there are no projects in Somalia, in either place. There are a ton of projects in Kenya, Tanzania, and there's some in Ethiopia. There are none in South Sudan. And it tells you the story that aid isn't necessarily getting to the places that need it the most. But it also doesn't tell you that if you put a bunch of aid in Somalia, whether it were bilateral or multilateral, that it could be spent well, particularly for climate adaptation. Because in the absence of a functioning government in Somalia, it's unclear if that's the best way to use resources. But what the maps can tell you when you overlay foreign assistance from at least those two entities is that aid isn't getting to the countries that may need it the most. Now, you know, could we spend aid on climate adaptation in Somalia? I'm uncertain about that. But if we don't know where the aid money is going in the first place, we can't really see, you know, are our dollars either multilaterally or bilaterally directed in the right places. So I'm part of the reason I'm in town is I'm now the disaster and humanitarian relief team leader for this new initiative that's funded by USAID that's called Aid Data, or the Aid Data Research Consortium, that's looking at georeferenced foreign assistance aid to see if we know this to a certain extent about climate vulnerability, what do we know about where our money's going? And so we've done some of that in some other work, but this is really the next step forward.
Other questions?
Now, one other thing that I wanted to say is that, you know, we've been doing Africa-related work for 5 years, and I'm struck by the events in the Philippines, and I've been thinking about this before. I went back to the MDAT International Disaster Database, and the numbers on disaster fatalities and affected populations are always suspect because they come from media reports. But when you do that for the last 30 years globally, and then you look at the sub-regional level, 90% of the disaster-affected populations and people killed are in Asia, right? And 90%. And the reason is, you know, you have large populations concentrated in coastal zones and in particularly vulnerable areas to, like, cyclone risk. And so a whole heft of intellectual energy, not just by our project, but there's been this assumption that Africa is the most vulnerable place, given low adaptive capacity. And that may be true in terms of share of population, but in terms of sheer numbers, Asia is, in a sense, I think where the future action is on this issue, and where I'm not gonna give up on the Africa story, it's an important one, but I think the Asia story, that piece of it is an understudied one by the climate security community and really needs a lot of intellectual energy. Yeah, that's right.
So, you know, a couple of things. One is that I noticed that, you know, the metrics when you look at U.S. interests did not improve, or at least I didn't see them. Number of U.S. businesses, trade volume, number of American citizens that are in the country, or the size of the embassy, all of which would give me a sense of how much Americans would care.
Right.
What's going on. The other thought that comes to mind, well, two thoughts. One is, you know, when you're thinking about data collection, there's a wonderful TED talk by Joel Selenikio on big data collection on healthcare stats using mobile apps, crowdsourcing,
mm-hmm.
And some wonderful examples of things like Rishikhi that have very rapid data collection.
Yeah.
And then, you know, what you'd want to ask those people, I think that would require some significant intellectual effort. But one of the things that when you talked about infrastructure, the fact that that's not the same, it occurred to me that what I haven't seen is, and I'm also principally interested in infrastructure because that's something proactively can do something about. I'm principally interested in aviation. So, you know, what's interesting to me is for any population cell, you know, what is their access within a certain number of hours to an airlift hub?
Right.
And then, you know, if you think about it more generally, what is that cell's what is their resiliency to other non-coupled cells? So, you know, if there are two and they're both cyclone risk, then maybe I don't want to be thinking that I'm going to get help from that guy. But it would be interesting to know, for instance, you know, how many independent roadways does a particular community have to other communities that might be able to help them. And things like that. I mean, it's one thing I can, for instance, today find decent data on the number of airfields.
Right.
But what I can't find is a model that shows me an airfield throughput capacity, which is really what tells me how well that particular airfield can serve
the world. Yeah, I think that's a great question. We did model initially, you know, distance from airports, but then it was unclear, you know, an airport, not all airports are created equal, and so then, it's like the airfield that is basically a field that some planes have landed on in the past is different from, you know, one that maybe has an actual more capacity for having, I don't know, a C-130 land. I think that's, you know, there may be other entities that have better data along those lines that we're just not privy to as using open source methods, but I would doubt that that's necessarily available continent-wide either. And so you might have things like a FuseNet program on famine early warning systems where they have a good sense of markets and infrastructure for the particular countries they study, but it's only a subset of countries in Africa, and it doesn't tell you a complete story. And, you know, in a sense, when we started this project, we, you know, didn't really know how much we were biting off, which was the scope of ambition was, can you do an entire continent at the subnational level? It's only now 5 years in that we realize that it's a hell of an endeavor given the paucity of data, and to get this far, and we feel like, you know, it's been at least. Gives us a glimpse of what could be possible even with better data. And so I hope that, if nothing else, that there's a sense that, you know, if we get some more data, we may be able to answer exactly the kinds of questions that you want. But we always need to come.
Let me ask you, the kind of one of the things that comes out of this is, oh, it's complicated. So
right.
there's a temptation to just throw your hands up and say, oh, it's complicated, we're never really going to know.
Yeah.
Does more data just make it more complicated and make it even more difficult to tease out all of these correlations and causations, and that kind of leads to moving away from these broad cross-sectional data analysis to kind of a scenario planning way forward. To, you know, I think both have their benefits and their drawbacks and everything.
Right.
You know, but are you running up against the point where, oh, we're learning as much as we can, or does more data really lead to a better analysis, a better product?
You know, I think yes. And so, you know, one of the limitations is that, you know, I think you have to do a deeper dive for particular places. And if you think that Somalia is going to be a chronic place of concern, then you might want to collect more discrete information about the infrastructure that's available in Somalia in terms of relief supplies, right? Or if you think that Eastern Ethiopia comes out in the model quite a lot, then you focus your energies accordingly on developing better data that's at the level of resolution you need for the problem at hand. Maybe what we've done with the continent-wide data is say, okay, let's focus your energies here, here, and here, and now we need additional information, whether it's in geographic form or if it's more qualitative data. It perhaps gives you some purchase on where to focus your energies, but there's only so much you can do if you're trying to do the continent as a whole at the same time. But you could say, all right, where are the airfields? I mean, you know, Somalia's come up again and again and again. Where are the airfields? Or where are the road networks? Maybe we say at the end of the day, you know, Somalia, you know, that's hard. I mean, there's less appetite for it. That's, you know, relatively speaking, it's maybe compared to other areas where we have higher strategic interest, maybe that isn't the place where we want to focus our intellectual energies. But within the African context, you know, Somalia and Nigeria loom large, and so then I think you just have to do a deeper dive in the places that come out of that. But there's only so much you can do if you're still looking at it at the sort of continent-wide level.
Yeah, so the continent-wide, and even, you know, not in yours, but other social science, you know, global-wide, it seems like you can run a regression equation that tells you whatever you want it to do sometimes, you know.
I wouldn't go that far, right. But, you know, the New York Times did a series of maps using remote sensing and spatial imagery after the recent cyclone that hit Philippines with Tacloban, and you could see the before and after pictures. Yeah. You could see, some sense of what were the affected roadways. And so in discrete emergencies, having that information possibly crowdsourced at the same time, supplemented by, you know, work by Ushahidi, that's been done in specific disaster episodes. What we want to do is have that capability in advance so that we're not always in a reactive mode and trying to think about, oh, what do we do now? If you have some sense of, okay, here are the depots that could, you know, that could be drawn on for areas that are, you know, chronically hit by these problems, That I think would be the right approach. Trying to do that continent-wide or globally for every place in the world is problematic. But if places are like persistently affected by these problems, then the kind of work that FuseNet has done with a deep dive with more fine-grained models for particular places, I think we could do that for disaster-prone places, and then we could collect all that information on a more regular basis. For those areas of concern.
So the map is useful in identifying areas that we should focus on and then do more of a fine-grained focus on it. I think that's an interesting takeaway.
Yeah.
Let me say, though, that there's a... I like how you initially set up about where does the United States care and where are our strategic interests.
Yeah.
But I want to point out that the map that your resiliency score gives is exactly not that. It is the areas I don't care about.
Right. Well,
because these are the places I'm not going to invest. Because if they have low governance scores, that means that they don't have the capacity for me to invest. This is the map where the United States does not care and will not invest.
So this is an issue about strategic and security outcomes, not about commercial interests.
No, but what I'm saying is that actually what would be useful is to think about how, because what I actually care about here is the peripheral states around these dark areas. It's not that I'm going to be putting effort into Somalia or into Ethiopia, but I am going to be putting effort into Kenya and growing Kenyan capacity to export security into those areas.
Right.
And I may not care about the DRC per se, but I probably am going to care about Cameroon and Gabon and how I'm going to export,
right,
and how I'm going to up them. So it's figuring out who is at the, you know, if you think about development as an S-curve,
right,
these guys in red are at the bottom of the S-curve. And I'm looking for the guys who are kind of in mid-swing or cresting. And I want to be able to put them over the top so that they can help their name. Yeah, that governance is a great one, right?
Yeah.
So it is the light areas next to the dark areas,
right,
that needs to be highlighted as where am I going to invest?
But that's a different question.
Is it?
I mean, look, the same amount of, you know, we're not going to intervene in Kenya at the same quickness that we
different questions as where should we be investing and what should we be investing to is not necessarily.
I think our, you know, if that's the take that you have on this analysis, then you can still use this map to tell you that story. That you can take the composite map or you can take the physical exposure map and say, okay, all right, from this perspective, you know, we see the places that come out from the physical perspective or from the overall perspective. Maybe if I'm interested in governance and helping, you know, improve the capacities of the neighbors, then I'm going to invest my energies here. And in a sense, that's what's happened, right? Aid dollars are going to the neighboring countries. You can't get many projects into the DRC. You can't get many projects into Somalia. You can't get many projects into South Sudan. You have the UN hunkered down right now at the moment in South Sudan in Juba, right? That's a real problem. How do you answer those kinds of questions with you could do short run humanitarian relief, or you can do long run investment in governance capacity, either in situ in those places or in the neighbors. But I think our maps can help you think about how to focus from both perspectives.
Well, Josh, I mean, yeah. The version of takeaway, my takeaway was somewhat different, which was, okay, one investment strategy, if you care about the security/climate, well, let's just ignore mitigation and adaptation per se. The focus is this, because as soon as I drive the colors to lighter color, the problems disappear from a security perspective. So one, it's not necessarily how I'd argue, because I care about mitigation.
Right.
I care about agriculture adaptation. But there's certainly an argument to be said is the top priority for investment should be getting that as light a color as possible overall, and that eliminates the security challenge for the nation. So that could be a a potential takeaway from this.
You know, I think about Botswana and South Africa, it's not as if they don't face physical exposure. They do, but you know, thinking about the standards of living that people have and the government, you know, flawed as it is, as we've seen with, you know, recent with Mandela's passing, that, you know, South Africa is not a perfect country, far from it, but relative to the rest of the continent, it has far more capability. And, you know, we don't have to be as preoccupied because they can handle some of those issues in ways that other countries simply cannot.
Well, I think we're getting close to it, so why don't we do these two here, and then...
Okay. You mentioned the very beginning is the final tier for the transfer. I'm wondering if anybody's looking to pick this up as far as Africa Command or another agency or activity to kind of continue the effort. If not, are you looking for more Minerva funding to do that? And you mentioned the Pacific, too, so I'm just
Good question. Yeah, so we're applying for new funding to extend the work to Asia and to keep the Africa work alive.
Through Minerva?
Through Minerva and other sources. So if anybody happens to have several million dollars that they would like to provide us, we'd be happy to accept it.
A similar question, I just want to know how much government participation you've had in this. You know, State Department in particular, DOD, and specifically AFRICOM.
Right.
I would submit to you that they would be, number one, very interested in your assessments. And
right.
Obviously would probably participate, I would think, particularly in some of your assessments with regards to governance.
Yeah.
I just want to know where you stand there.
So obviously funded by them, we have to do annual presentations. I think this is an area that was sort of funded before there was an obvious interest within Africa Command for this particular kind of work. So we, in a sense, we've done some kind of interest generation. We've had a number of conferences. I think you came down for one in Austin, Steve. And we had, you know, at least two rounds of conferences with Africa Command coming to Austin, some representatives. We've done briefings all around town. I've gone to Stuttgart. I think we've done as much work as we can to kind of generate interest. But, it is a complex portrait. It doesn't necessarily have the obvious, like, yes, unambiguously, climate causes conflict, or, you know, and here is the, you know, key answer for the U.S.
On the intervention
point. It's a more muddy portrait, but I think it's the important analytical work that has to be done for this policy and research agenda to survive and not go the way of the sort of aid security community that, you know, 10 years now gone on is completely dissipated.
Well, any final thoughts from the audience, or Josh, any final thoughts to leave us with before we break, and this is the end of our work for the year?
Well, I appreciate all of you coming out right before the holidays. Feel free to ping me. I've got cards. Look at our data tool, and happy to provide any additional information as needed. And you know, we are expanding this work into Asia. I've done some blogging about that on Duck of Minerva and other places. And I'm also always willing to write on discrete topics. So if you work for outlets that need some analytical work directed for particular problems, I'm always interested in new writing.
We'll take the slides and we'll put them up on our website, as well as putting the recording of the presentation up as well. So you'll be able to get up there and see what we've seen and everything like that. So Josh, thanks very much, and thank you all for coming, and happy holidays.
Okay. Thank you.